From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The situation in the refugee camp of Jenin and the whole city in Nablus is grave. The ambulances have not been able. It's handled by the Israeli army from evacuating injured people and dead people for over 3 days now. Water, electricity, and the hospitals are not functioning at all. The situation has been a grave humanitarian situation.
Israeli soldiers raid the Jenin refugee camp, killing at least 30, but the Palestinian Red Crescent Society is blocked from the camp and doctors in the Jenin hospital can't get out. Since Israel began its latest siege 10 days ago, thousands of Palestinians have been arbitrarily detained and arrested by Israeli soldiers. Human rights organizations say the military is violating Israeli and international law. Then, as the Justice Department announces it will seek the death penalty for accused hijacker Zacharias Massawi, we go to the second part of our interview with his mother in France. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is vowing his military invasion of the West Bank is at the point of no return and will continue until it is completed. He says Israel has given up hope. Any agreement with the Palestinians will bring his nation peace. Sharon's comments are in defiance of President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who met in Crawford, Texas over the weekend, demanding that Israel begin a withdrawal without delay. But National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice gave conflicting messages on CBS's Face the Nation. She said the administration understands Israel's military mobilization cannot be reversed instantly. But she said, quote, "The important point is to begin now without delay, not tomorrow, not when Secretary Powell gets to the region, but now." In fact, Bush had not used the term without delay when he first announced Thursday night Colin Powell would be going to Israel within the week, leading many Palestinians to say Bush had given Sharon the green light to continue his operations. Meanwhile, Secretary of State General Colin Powell has arrived in Morocco for meetings with King Mohammed VI and Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah. As many as a million people took to the streets of Morocco's capital over the weekend to protest the invasion of the West Bank. Powell's trip this week also includes meetings with President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt and King Abdullah in Jordan. He will also visit Spain, where he'll meet with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov, and European leaders. He will not arrive in Israel until Friday, and Palestinians charge Powell's itinerary is encouraging Israel to continue the invasion. Meanwhile, Israel's escalating its attacks in the West Bank. Helicopter gunships and tanks attacked the refugee camp of Jenin on Saturday. Palestinian sources say the assault left 35 dead, unknown numbers of dead and wounded in the streets. They say the Israelis have blocked ambulances and are asking for world leaders to intervene. 7 Israeli soldiers have also died there. In Nablus, tanks and helicopters continue to pound the city. Residents say many houses and some mosques were destroyed by missiles fired from U.S.-made Apache attack helicopters. The Israeli army says it's killed 30 Palestinians in the city since Friday. The head of the United Nations agency responsible for Palestinian refugees called on the Israeli army to end its pitiless assault on civilian refugee camps in Nablus and Jenin. He said reports of, quote, pure horror had been coming in of helicopters strafing civilian residential areas, systematic shelling by tanks, and of bulldozers razing refugee homes. Meanwhile, elite Israeli troops in Bethlehem shot and killed a young Palestinian as he attempted to put out a fire in a building adjoining the besieged Church of the Nativity. Some 200 Palestinians are taking refuge from Israeli troops there. The clergy have been feeding the Palestinians but ran out of food on Saturday. This news from Rome. Franciscans who've been working for a peaceful solution today condemned the Israeli attack as an act of indescribable barbarity. Father David Jaeger, who's a spokesperson for custodians of Catholic sites in the Holy Land, called the act, quote, a violation of every law of humanity and civilization, and that the consequences will be long-term and incalculable. He said, quote, we put our trust in God and we appeal to the whole world to condemn this act and stop this behavior from continuing. Jaeger also accused Israel of putting pressure on Franciscan monks to leave and said this may be a prelude to an attack on Palestinians inside. Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets of South America, to Asia, to Israel itself over the weekend to protest against Israel in the United States. In Tel Aviv, more than 10,000 Jews and Israeli Arabs marched together Saturday night, demanding the government withdraw from the West Bank and immediately resume peace talks with the Palestinians. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting that for the first time in the history of anti-war protests in Israel, a group of war widows is calling for an end to the bloodshed. The group's first public move will be the publication of an advertisement under the banner "No More." In Morocco, an estimated 1 million people gathered in the capital Rabat in a protest Sunday. The rally marked the first march officially authorized in Morocco since the Intifada. A protester died in Bahrain on Sunday, 2 days after being hit in the head with a rubber bullet or tear gas canister. The 24-year-old may be the first person to be killed outside the occupied territories in the protests of the Israeli invasion. Bahrain's government is investigating whether Mohamed Jomah was killed by the Bahraini police or U.S. Marines inside the U.S. Embassy. The largest protests in Europe took place in Rome on Saturday, where 50,000 rallied. Tens of thousands more demonstrated across France, Switzerland, and Germany. In the United States, thousands marched demanding Washington withdraw military, economic, and diplomatic support for Israel. In New York, protesters marched across the Brooklyn Bridge, eliciting supportive honks from drivers. One sign read, "The Palestinians are Israel's Jews." This news from Kabul. Victims of the bombing in Afghanistan handed in petitions from 400 families to the American embassy yesterday, part of a growing movement to demand compensation from the United States for the loss of their families and homes. Dozens of families traveled to Kabul from all over the country to tell harrowing stories of whole families lost and of children maimed in the bombing. An 8-year-old girl named Amina, who lost 16 relatives in the bombing, her entire family except her father, handed the heavy folder of petitions to Michael Matrinko, who heads the U.S. Embassy's political and consular sections. The petitioners represent just some of possibly thousands of civilians who suffered U.S. bombing. A spokesperson for Global Exchange, who helped organize the petition, said it's the responsibility of the U.S. government to do a survey and help the innocent civilians. And in an expanded lawsuit expected to be filed today, Enron shareholders accuse some of the country's top financial institutions of knowingly participating in a scheme to defraud them, adding new details about deals involving banks and investment firms that kept Enron afloat even as its finances were falling apart.
Perfect harmony. That's the way it should be, right? To survive, you gotta have self-determination and a whole lot of faith. In this world, you need friends, family, people you can depend on. In the crisis, we gotta survive.
That's Crisis, Sounds of Blackness, Time for Hearing, Healing, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Helicopter gunships and tanks attacked the refugee camp of Jenin on Saturday. Palestinian sources say the assault left more than 30 people dead, dozens dead and wounded in the streets. They say the Israelis have blocked ambulances and are asking for world leaders to intervene. 7 Israeli soldiers have died there. In Nablus, tanks and helicopters to continue to pound the city. Residents say many houses and some mosques were destroyed by missiles fired from U.S.-made Apache attack helicopters. We turn now to Dr. Ali Jabarin, who is a pediatrician inside Jenin Hospital. Welcome to Democracy Now! Dr. Jabarin. It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us what's happening in Jenin right now?
The situation in Jenin town and mainly in Jenin camp is getting more worse. Till now, 7 days ago, we are still in curfew. We are unable, as medical teams, we are unable to get out from our hospital. and all Red Cross and the Red Crescent are unable to get out from Jenin to go in Jenin town to bring the injured persons and the victims that are lying in the streets and roads of the Jenin camps. But first of all, I would like to urge strongly to all Red Cross in the world and all Red Crescent in the world and all organizations and all associations for human rights to move very quickly to let us as medical teams and ambulances to move freely without delay to give medical help for injured persons and for victims. Till now, we are unable to get out from our hospital. 4 days ago, we did not receive any injured persons because of curfew and because ambulances are unable to get or to bring any more injured persons. Here in Jenin and Jenin camp, there is no electricity, no water, no foods, and in hospitals, there is severe reduction in the amount of drugs and amount of food and the amount of medical supplies and medical instruments. And here in our hospital and in other hospitals, we work with a reduced number of medical teams, doctors and nurses, because they are unable to arrive to our hospital because of curfew.
We are talking right now to a doctor inside the Jenin Hospital. He is unable to get out for the last 5 days. We are also joined on the telephone by Yunus Al-Khatib, who is president of the Palestine Red Crescent Society. Can you get into the Jenin refugee camp in northern West Bank?
And the last time we heard from persons who have relatives there in Jenin camp, that the situation is a disaster there. There is massacres there. And they said to us that they transferred many people out of Jenin camp to near villages here in Jenin.
Dr. Ali Jabrin, we want to also hear from Yunus Al-Khatib, president of the Palestine Red Crescent Society. How close are you able to get to Jenin? Dr. Jabarin, we also have Yunus Al-Khatib on the phone, so we're going to get a response from him.
Yes.
But stay on.
What we are witnessing in the Palestinian territories, and specifically in Jenin and Nablus now, is unprecedented violations of international humanitarian law and of the Geneva Conventions and the human rights. What's happening is grave. There is a catastrophe at hand. There has been destruction of most of the infrastructure of Palestinian cities all over the West Bank. We haven't been able till now, after several days, to get into Jenin refugee camps and evacuate the wounded and the dead. The Israeli army today, for the first time, gave the green light to the International Committee of the Red Cross, allowing the Red Crescent ambulances to move into the Jenin refugee camp. After approaching the camp, we were shot at by the Israeli soldiers and the tanks surrounding the refugee camp, and we had to withdraw, pull back, we and the Red Cross. What is happening is grave. What is happening are atrocities against civilians in these areas. Not just that, there are atrocities against the medical missions that are trying to save and evacuate the lives of the Palestinians in these areas. And this is not new. This has been going on, atrocities against medical missions going on for the last 18 months. But it is intensifying in the last few weeks. This is unacceptable, and the international community should move to put an end to a massacre that is being conducted specifically in Jenin and in Nablus. I would like also to add that medical missions, ambulance medics, have been used by the Israeli army as human shield to storm into certain areas, like it happened in Nablus yesterday and in Ramallah before that. Several of our medics have been used as human shields, pushing them, marching in front of their tanks and in front of their soldiers to storm areas and to protect themselves. This atrocity is totally unacceptable when it comes to medical missions and to civilians. They have been arresting our medics throughout the Palestinian cities. Until now, we had over 25 medics arrested from their ambulances, forced out of their ambulances, handcuffed and blindfolded and taken to a detention camp. Till now, we have six are still in detention camps, and the Israelis are refusing to let them go. They have continuously attacked our centers, not just the ambulances, even the centers, the hospitals in Jenin area. The hospital that Dr. Jabarin is working in, it has been attacked with sound bombs. The oxygen was cut off from the center, from the hospital. In another NGO hospital in Jenin itself, the upper floor, the fifth floor of the hospital, was shelled and totally burned. This is unacceptable. PRCS, the Red Crescent Centers, have been used as detention camp in a town in North West Bank, in Annapta. They occupied our center there, and they used it as a detention camp. A few of the EMS, the emergency stations for the ambulances, have been occupied by the Israeli army in Yatta and Tubas. How could we work in a situation where you feel every minute targeted by an army that has lost all morals when it comes to protection of civilians and humanitarian missions?
We're talking to the head of the Palestine Red Crescent Society, Yunus Al-Khatib, also on the line with us, Dr. Ali Jabarin, who is a pediatrician at Jenin Hospital, has not been able to leave for 5 days. Let me ask Dr. Jabarin. In the New York Times, they're saying a spokesperson for the Israeli army said said that fire from Palestinian gunmen has been preventing medics from reaching the wounded. What about that characterization?
We are unable to receive any medical instruments or drugs or foods even from other near villages or other sites. And the situation is very bad. I would like to add here that I heard from many persons who received funds from their relatives that they transfer tens of people from Jenin camp, and they left them undressed, and they led them to unknown direction. And now they are collected in near village of Jenin, village of Romana.
Yes, go ahead. Yunus Al-Khatib.
Yes. Can I comment on that specific issue about shooting? I want to talk about a personal experience I went through. When we went out a few days ago to evacuate a number of wounded, we had three ambulances dispatched to start evacuating wounded people. 2 kilometers away from the scene, it was a totally quiet area. There was no shooting over there. We were surrounded by Israeli tanks and then forced out of the ambulances, detained and handcuffed and blindfolded and taken to detention. It is a complete lie that the Israeli army has been trying to portray to the world outside, disinformation campaign about shooting, and we cannot allow them in. Well, let's talk frankly. I mean, the Red Cross cars have been shot at and have been crushed by Israeli tanks while parking in front of our emergency stations. This is unacceptable. We have, in the last 3 days, 7 of our ambulances crashed by tanks in Tulkarim, 4 in Tulkarim and 3 in Bethlehem, while just standing there waiting in front of our emergency medical services station. The tanks just walk into them. And this happened to Red Cross cars.
You're both describing events that have all occurred since Thursday night, since President Bush made the announcement that Colin Powell will be coming to the region within a week. It sounds like that the killings are intensifying. Can you say what you expect from Colin Powell's visit? Did you see the speech as a green light for Sharon to do what he wanted until the point where Colin Powell arrives?
Well, these events have been taking place for the last 11 months since the Israeli army moved in. I'm describing things in the most recent 3 days, but it has been going on for the last 11 days. We are a humanitarian agency. We look for peace. We are not politicians. We look for not just Mr. Powell, but to the world community to intervene. We look for Powell to put an end to these atrocities, to put an end to this situation, to put an end to what's happening here, to this war, and that Palestinians are aspiring for freedom, and occupation cannot be kept as a sword on the necks of the Palestinians. This situation has to end. Every people in the world, we are the only people in the world now under occupation. This is the only occupation that exists in the universe, and we look forward to the United States and to the visit of Powell to put an end to this horrific situation that we are living in now.
Dr. Ali Jabarin, as we wrap up, inside the Jenin Hospital, what do you expect to happen right now? When did you last get out of the hospital?
We did not receive any injured persons here. We still wait for injured persons and for other patients. We received just scattered numbers of patients who is near our hospital, and he is able to arrive to our hospital to search to seek medical help. And I would like to add, yesterday they left curfew for 2 to 3 hours. I tried to go to my home to see my sons and my family. I returned back because there is many tanks in the town, and I failed. I did not succeed to arrive or to reach my house to see my sons and my family.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Dr. Ali Jabarin, pediatrician inside Jenin Hospital, and Yunus Al-Khatib, president of the Palestine Red Crescent Society. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to speak with a young Palestinian man who can see into the Balata refugee camp from his house in Nablus to give us a update on the situation there. We're going to go to Tel Aviv to speak with the major organizers of the Israeli protests that took place over the weekend. More than 10,000 Israelis in the streets of Tel Aviv. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Oh, you may say I'm just a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one. Oh, Lord. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't very hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, my Lord, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. Oh Lord, you may say I'm just a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us. someday you'll join us. And the world will be as one.
The Persuasion, singing John Lennon's Imagine. Here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, I'm Amy Goodman. Over the weekend in Tel Aviv, more than 10,000 Israelis marched in the streets. We're joined on the telephone by Adam Keller, a spokesperson for Gush Shalom. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yes, thank you.
Can you tell us about this protest?
Yes. First of all, for honesty, Gush Shalom, my own movement, was not the main organizer of this movement, of this demonstration. It was organized by Peace Now, which is a bigger and a little bit more mainstream peace movement, and we very willingly joined it. And it was a manifestation, the biggest manifestation so far of opposition to this mad war of Sharon. We had earlier a demonstration in Jerusalem in which there were 3,000 people trying to get food into Ramallah, and we were then very violently dispersed by the police. And there had been several other smaller protests since the whole thing began, but that was the biggest. And it brought together quite different factions and groups, some people who are very radical, not only against the occupation, but in general, in the general view of life. And some people are more moderate, who consider themselves as Israeli patriots, but opposed to the policy of Sharon government and expressing it by waving Israeli national flags. And there were, of course, Jews and Arabs, very different groups, which all came together for this particular protest.
And how many people would you estimate were there?
I think that the estimate of 10,000 was fair enough. There were some people giving lower numbers, some people giving higher numbers, but I think 10,000 is more or less how many there were.
What about what Sharon is saying right now? The Israeli government and army indicating they intend to carry on with the broad military sweep through the West Bank, saying that they will defend themselves. You're an Israeli. What's your response to your leader?
I'm, of course, very much opposed to this whole policy. But you should not think of it as something which happened just out of the blue. It is in fact what Sharon has been planning ever since he came to power, and in fact I think before he came to power, when he was very few people saw that he could come to power, but he was making contingency plans. He is you have to give it that he is a clever general, at least in tactics. I don't think he has a very long-term strategy, but his policy since the beginning of his government was to progressively erode the semi-sovereign areas of under Palestinian rule, to find always a pretext to go ever deeper into them, and to in fact to break up the structures which were created by the Oslo Agreement, and to renew the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. That is his plan, and he was going step by step, and always wanting to keep with him on the internal front the Labor Party as members of his cabinet, and on the external front the support of the United States. And always when these two factors, the United States on the outside and the Labor Party on the inside, were making trouble, then he was willing to take a step back. But then when the next case came, then he was always starting from where he left off in the previous time. So started with bombings by helicopter gunships, afterwards bombings with airplanes. Afterwards, small incursions into uninhabited parts of the Palestinian territories, then into inhabited parts, but for a short time, for one night, then for a longer time, then taking over whole neighborhoods, then taking over whole towns. And you could, when you look over the last year, then you see very clearly the how everything which he did was leading up to this. And of course, the suicide bombings very much played into his hands. And there was always Palestinians doing things which gave him the pretext. And when it did not happen out of itself, then he always found a way to do a provocation which would cause a suicide bombing, which would give him the pretext to do the next stage. And that is how we got to where we are now.
We're talking to Adam Keller, spokesperson for Gush Shalom, one of the groups involved with the major Peace Now rally in Tel Aviv on Saturday. About 10,000 people marched. Also yesterday, Israel's High Court of Justice heard an urgent petition from four Israeli human rights groups concerned about the treatment of recently detained Palestinian prisoners. The petition was filed after one of the groups, B'Tselem, received information from an Israeli prison source that Palestinians are being tortured. The source also said the prisoners have been denied basic medical treatment. The court, however, rejected the human rights group's petition. Since Israel began its siege 10 days ago, thousands of Palestinians have been arbitrarily detained and arrested by Israeli soldiers. The soldiers roam the streets, searching house to house, removing men between the ages of 15 and 45. Some reports say over 15,000 men have been detained in Ramallah alone. No one knows exactly what's happened to them. Beyond the disappearances, there have been reports of widespread human rights violations. Jessica Montel is on the line with us, who is executive director of B'Tselem, the leading Israeli human rights group monitoring the situation in the occupied territories. Can you tell us about this petition that your groups filed before the Israeli High Court of Justice and its rejection of them?
Yes, as you said, the information came from an Israeli source in the prison who did not speak about denial of medical treatment at all, but the issue of interrogations, and specifically that one of the methods of interrogation was breaking detainees' toes. It was clear from the report that it was not even necessarily someone sympathetic with B'Tselem, but that was, somehow could not deny, once we finally spoke with them, what was actually taking place, and that it was not, you know, one or two Palestinians that this was being done to. It's the first time that we had heard any allegations of this type. I should say that access to information in the occupied territories now is extremely difficult. There is no shortage of phone calls from Palestinians in distress requesting assistance, but our traditional methods of taking and verifying information are simply not functioning now. Our field workers cannot travel freely. No one can travel freely. There are shortages of electricity, which then impacts on telephone and mobile phone service. So when we do get a report from a soldier inside the prison, it is something that is difficult to ignore. I would have thought it would be difficult for the High Court to ignore as well, but that was not the case. In our petition to the High Court, we asked both that attorneys be given access to detainees. It's clear when no one has access to them that they have no protection from abuse or no one who can supervise the conditions in which they're being held. And we also pointed to the source that we had about torture in the Ofer detention camp next to Ramallah. The court denied the petition, upheld the military order that prohibits all detainees rounded up over the past week from meeting with an attorney for 18 days, and did not address the allegations of torture.
What about your response, Jessica Montel, to the Israeli military and government position of Ariel Sharon that all of this must be done to rout out terrorism and that this is being done for the national security of Israel?
Well, it's clear that I am extremely concerned about terrorism. I think every Israeli is justifiably very concerned about their own safety, and it's clear that the government has to do everything they can to protect us. The question is how the wide-scale military offensive in the occupied territories, which imposes tremendous suffering on the Palestinian population, is going to ensure my security. It's not a war between the Israeli army and offensive army launched on Jerusalem. It's largely a civilian population, and the means of violence that they are imposing against Israelis is something that it's not at all clear to me how this offensive is going to prevent. The idea that 17-year-old boys and girls strap explosives to their body and turn themselves into weapons in order to attack innocent Israeli civilians. Certainly the fact that now those same 17-year-old boys and girls have been living under siege for a week with continual aerial and ground bombardments by Israeli forces, cut off from electricity and water, living in terror, it's difficult for me to imagine how that is going to reduce the willingness for these people, again, to turn themselves into human weapons.
Do you expect anything to come out of Colin Powell's visit?
I very much hope that Colin Powell will effect a ceasefire in the offensive in the occupied territories. I think the United States has to be even more outspoken than Bush has been over the past few days in calling on Israel immediately to leave the Palestinian cities and ensuring that human rights for all parties, for Israelis and Palestinians, are an integral and primary part of the ceasefire. We've seen in the past that when international law and human rights are neglected along the sidelines, that was certainly the case during the Oslo process and during previous ceasefires, the result is that it's very short-lived. If Palestinians and Israelis do not have a sense of hope and a sense of security and a sense of being able to live in dignity, there is no possibility that any diplomatic process is going to be successful.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Jessica Montiel, speaking to us from Israel, Executive Director of B'Tselem, leading Israeli human rights organization. Before that, we're talking with Adam Keller, spokesperson for Gush Shalom. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we return from our break, we're going to go to the second part of our interview with the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui, who has been charged with who is facing the death penalty in the United States, being called the 20th hijacker by the U.S. Justice Department. Stay with us.
And there is a cloud hanging over this land. It's looking to rain on down on each woman and man. Cause the freedom that you take, the only freedom that you make, so I'll take some from you. If you take some from me, I know we'll agree. When freedom is our goal, one day it may be. When freedom is our goal, oh yeah, only the outlaws are free.
Moogie Friedman, only outlaws are free. Here on Democracy Now!, Moogie Klingman, you are listening to the exception to the rulers. The Justice Department recently announced it'll seek the death penalty for Zacharias Moussaoui, the French citizen accused of being the 20th hijacker in the attacks on the Pentagon and World Trade Center. Moussaoui was nowhere near the crime scene on September 11th, but prosecutors believe he would have been had he not been in prison. He was arrested on immigration charges in the middle of August, just weeks before the attacks, only later linked to al-Qaeda and accused of being a terrorist. The 33-year-old entered the United States in February of 2001, immediately began trying to learn to fly. According to the FBI, he flunked out of flight school in Norman, Oklahoma, moved on to the Pan Am International Flying Academy in Minnesota, where he paid $8,000 to use flight simulators designed to train commercial pilots. His instructors became suspicious. The school called the FBI, which detained Moussaoui on August 17th on immigration charges. At the time of his arrest, FBI agents say they found flight manuals for the Boeing 747-400, a flight simulator computer program, binoculars, two knives, fighting shields, and a laptop computer. They say they later learned that French intelligence officials suspected Moussaoui of involvement with Islamic extremists. Moussaoui is the only person so far to stand trial for the September 11th attacks. He'll be tried on these charges in Virginia this September. News that the U.S. will seek the death penalty for him has sparked outrage in France. The country's justice minister said it'll not turn over evidence that could lead to a death sentence and will oppose the death penalty if Moussaoui is convicted. Like other European nations, France abolished capital punishment years ago. Well, several days ago, Democracy Now! did one of the first interviews with the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui at her home in France. It was her first conversation with an American reporter since the Justice Department announced it would seek the death penalty for her son. We continue now with that interview with Aisha Owafa, who is the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui. We pick up with her as she describes her reaction to the news that her son could be sentenced to death. She's translated by Sputnik Colombia reporter for Free Speech Radio News. This is Aisha Owafi.
Ma réaction, c'est comme toutes les mères qui sont détruites à l'intérieur que j'arrive pas à comprendre parce que à partir du moment où mon fils il était en prison le 17 ou le 16 août et que l'attentat il était le 11 septembre, pour moi mon fils il n'est pas responsable d'aucun attentat. Et donc
I react like any other mother. I'm completely torn up inside, anguished inside. Moreover, my son was in a US jail on the 16th of August and the attacks took place on the 11th of September, so I do not see how my son can be involved in this.
S'il vous plaît, oui. Je veux lui dire tout d'abord que mes pensées et tous les chagrins de tous ces gens qui sont morts et qu'ils ont perdu le leur et qui sont malheureux comme moi, je n'arrête pas de penser à eux et que c'était des gens aussi malheureux comme moi. Donc mes pensées et partent à tous ces gens qui ont perdu le leur et je partage leur malheur et je partage leur douleur avec eux.
I want to again say that my feelings and my thoughts are with the families of the victims of September 11th. They are as unhappy as me. I cannot stop thinking about them. I want to reiterate my deepest condolences and my feelings for these people. Oui.
We're talking to the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui. She is Aisha Owafi, and she's in France. When did you learn that your son was being held in jail in the United States, picked up in mid-August, 3 weeks before the September 11th attacks, and remained in jail through that period, through September 11th, until this day?
Quand est-ce que vous avez appris que votre fils a été arrêté aux États-Unis, c'est-à-dire 3 semaines donc avant ces attentats du 11 septembre? Comment vous avez appris ça?
C'est-à-dire que le mois de, au début août, il y avait la DST qui m'a téléphoné, elle m'a demandé si j'ai vu Zachary, si j'ai des nouvelles de Zachary. Et je lui ai répondu que non. Et je lui demandais pourquoi vous cherchez Zachary. Il m'a dit, il n'y a rien. Je lui dis, s'il n'y a rien, pourquoi vous cherchez? Il m'a dit, parce qu'on sait qu'il est en Amérique.
Ah, un instant, s'il vous plaît. So oui. At the beginning of August, I was contacted by the DST, the French Secret Service, who asked me if I'd had any news of my son Zacharias. And I asked them why they wanted to know. And they asked me if I'd known anything about him being in the States, and but they said they couldn't give me any information. So that was in the beginning of August when the French Secret Service contacted me. Oui?
Après, je lui dis, alors si vous savez qu'il est en Amérique, pourquoi vous me le demandez? Vous devez savoir mieux que moi, parce que moi, j'ai pas de nouvelles. J'étais pas là, j'étais voir ma mère au Maroc. J'ai trouvé dans le téléphone... un message, bonjour maman, je t'embrasse, je t'aime, tu n'es pas là, c'est dommage, au revoir, c'est tout.
And in fact, I asked them if they knew that my son was in the United States, why were they asking me for news about him? Moreover, I was at my family's house in Morocco for some of the time, and when I came back, I found a message on my answer phone from my son saying, Mama, I love you, I'm all right, and I embrace you all.
Oui. Et après, je lui dis, mais qu'est-ce qu'il fait en Amérique? Et il m'a dit, on le sait parce qu'il a un visa, il a demandé un visa.
And then I asked them, what is he doing in America? How do you know he's in America? They said, we know that he's there because he's asked for a visa.
Et je lui dis, alors, vous savez où il est? Il m'a dit, non, on sait qu'il est parti en Amérique, c'est tout.
So I asked them again, so you know where he is. They said, no, no, all we know is that he's gone to America.
Et donc après, peut-être même pas trois semaines, quinze jours après, le 11 septembre, moi j'étais en train de regarder la télé l'après-midi, j'ai vu l'attentat, mais je ne savais pas que c'était un attentat, je croyais que c'était un film. Après, j'étais restée, je dis c'est pas possible, qu'est-ce qui arrive? Et après, j'avais un rendez-vous chez le dentiste, j'ai annulé pour regarder ça. Et après, j'ai attendu que c'était un attentat et tout. Et le 13 septembre, ma fille, elle m'appelle au téléphone, « Maman, réveille-toi, Zachary, il est à la télé. »
So, in fact, two or three weeks later, I was in front of my television when I saw the September 11th attacks. Initially, I didn't believe that these were real. I thought it was a film. And I cancelled a dentist appointment and sat there watching these events and couldn't believe what was happening. It was horrific. And 2 days later, on the 13th of September, my daughter calls me and tells me, Mama, Mama, wake up. Zacharias is on the television.
Et après, quand j'ai allumé la télé, évidemment, il n'y a rien du tout. Et j'ai attendu jusqu'à la lecture de la presse à 8h30. Et j'ai vu Zacharias. Et je croyais mourir, et je croyais la maison me tombe sur la tête. Je tapais ma tête, je pris sa photo, je tapais par terre. Je dis c'est pas possible, c'est pas vrai, qu'est-ce qu'il y a? Et j'ai attendu jusqu'à 9h pour appeler à la police. Ils m'ont dit non, c'est pas lui, c'est trompé. J'ai dit non, je me trompe pas, c'est mon fils. Et ils m'ont dit bon, on t'appellera plus tard. Il m'a appelé 2 heures après. Il m'a dit oui, madame, on regrette, c'est votre fils.
And then I switched on the television immediately when my daughter called me. Obviously, there was no news. I had to wait until the news at 8 o'clock, 8:30, and then I saw my son's face and my son's name on the television. I felt that the roof had caved in on me. I was completely upset. I took my son's photograph. I was crying. I was upset. I rang the police at 9 o'clock, asked them what was happening. They said, no, no, madam, it's not your son. Then finally, two hours later, they called me and said, effectively, it is your son who was picked up in the States.
Jusqu'aujourd'hui, ma vie devient un cauchemar.
And my life has been a nightmare ever since.
There's a piece in the latest American magazine, Newsweek, that says, in the months leading up to September 11th, Zacharias Moussaoui was trying desperately to learn to fly. He went to flight school in Norman, Oklahoma, and when instructors there decided he had almost no aptitude for handling a light plane, he moved on to Minnesota, seeking practice time on a flight simulator for a Boeing 747. Did you know anything about his wanting to learn to fly in the United States?
Il y a un article dans un magazine américain qui s'appelle Newsweek sur votre fils, donc il raconte comment il a essayé d'apprendre à voler. Il s'est inscrit dans une école de vol à Oklahoma et ensuite il a essayé autre part. Est-ce que vous saviez à un instant que votre fils s'intéressait à apprendre à voler?
Non, non. Moi, c'est la police qui me... C'est le journal, la police, que j'ai attendu ça, mais sinon, moi, je suis pas en courant, comme je vous dis. Ça fait 4 ans que quand il y avait le mois de septembre, ça fait près 4 ans que j'ai pas vu. Je l'ai au téléphone, c'est tout. Je connais pas tout ça. Je sais. J'ai pris comme tout le monde tout ça par les journaux qu'il avait prêt à piloter l'avion, qu'il a été en Amérique, qu'il a fait ci, qu'il a fait ça comme tout le monde. Mais je ne sais rien de tout ça.
No, I didn't know anything about all this. It had been 4 years that I'd had any news of him apart from this one phone call. All that I know is like everybody else, what I've read in the newspapers and what I've seen on the television. But I don't know. I didn't have any information at all about all this.
The Newsweek article goes on to say, and you might want to simultaneously translate this. I'll just read one paragraph, Sputnik.
Yeah.
After Zacharias was busted on immigration charges, French authorities told the FBI that he was a known Islamic militant. The FBI says it later found evidence that Moussaoui got $14,000 in cash from a key operative of the Al-Qaeda cell in Hamburg, Germany, that organized the 9/11 attacks.
Apparemment, les Français, les autorités françaises auraient dit aux Américains que Zacharias Moussavi était un islamiste connu, qu'il avait reçu 14 000 dollars de la part de... Who did he get the $14,000 from?
From a key operative of the Qaeda cell in Hamburg, Germany.
Il aurait reçu 14 000 dollars d'un membre clé de l'organisation Al-Qaïda. Est-ce que vous avez entendu tout ça?
And then finally, it says, when he saw the ruins of the World Trade Center from the air as he was being flown back to New York by federal agents after the attacks, Moussaoui allegedly yelled, F America, F you, America.
Et apparemment, quand votre fils aurait vu les ruines du World Trade Center à New York, il aurait hurlé des insultes contre les États-Unis. Est-ce que vous avez entendu tout ça?
J'ai pas entendu ça parce que j'ai vu les journaux comme vous, qu'est-ce que vous avez dit dans les journaux, mais je comment vous voulez que je le sais tout ça? Parce que moi, mon fils, je l'ai pas vu depuis 4 ans maintenant et demi, parce que ça fait 6 mois ou 7 mois qu'il est là-bas. Moi, je ne peux pas répondre à ça parce que je vois et j'attends qu'est-ce que vous voyez dans la télé comme moi, comme vous. Je ne peux pas vous dire le vrai et le faux. Je ne sais rien. Moi, je sais que avant, quand il me téléphonait, je lui demande comme toutes les mamans, est-ce qu'il va se marier? Est-ce qu'il va faire des enfants? Est-ce qu'il va venir me voir? Mais tout ce qu'est-ce que j'ai attendu, qu'est-ce que vous dites là, je l'ai attendu à la radio ou à la télévision, c'est tout, mais je ne sais rien du tout.
I don't know anything more than what I've told you. As I said, I haven't seen him for 4 years before that, and all I know is what I read in the newspapers and hear on the television, like the rest of you. I had absolutely no idea as to what he was up to. All I know is that when he called me, I was interested, like any other mother, to find out how my son was, when he was going to get married, did he plan to have children, when he was going to come and see me. I had no idea of any of this other information. I only read it in the papers. I've heard about these things, like all of you. I don't know anything myself.
May I ask, if it's not too personal, why you hadn't been in contact with your son in 4 years?
Si c'est pas trop personnel, est-ce que je peux vous demander pourquoi vous n'aviez pas de contact avec votre fils pendant 4 ans?
C'est-à-dire que depuis qu'il est parti en Angleterre, il est parti de la maison, il avait 22 ans, il n'est pas parti jeune. Donc, il fit sa vie, il me téléphone, c'est tout. Mais de voir, moi, je lui demande pas. Je pense qu'il viendra s'il avait envie de venir. Il est venu en 97 et je lui demandais de venir s'installer en France. Il m'a dit, non, je travaille dans une agence temporaire. Je travaille dans l'informatique. Je fais du commerce international. J'aime bien l'Angleterre. Je veux rester là-bas. Et quand je veux m'installer, tu viendras me voir. Mais c'est tout. À 22 ans, je ne crois pas que je veux l'imposer de venir me voir tous les dimanches.
Oui, he was 22 when he left home, when he decided to go to England. And at the age of 22, I consider he was a man, and I couldn't tell him anything. And he told me when he came in 97, when he visited me in France, that he was happy in England. He'd done a computer course. He was doing something in marketing. When I said I'd like him to settle down in France, he said no, he was happy in England. And in fact, that when he was settled, that I should come and visit him there. But he was a grown man, and he had left home. I didn't feel it was in my place to ask him any questions, and I only knew what he told me.
Je veux lui dire que moi, j'étais mariée jeune, et mes parents, ils m'ont toujours commandé, et ça, je l'aime pas. Et alors, moi, j'ai jamais commandé mes enfants. Et mes enfants, je les ai élevés laïquement, et je n'ai jamais imposé quoi que ce soit pour mes enfants.
I was married off very young. I had my children very young, but I have never ordered my children around. I have never imposed anything on them, and I've brought them up in a secular manner, not in a religious manner.
Could you tell me a little about your background? Where were you born, and where were your children born?
Est-ce que vous pouvez nous raconter un peu sur vous-même, où est-ce que vous êtes né et vos enfants?
Ah, moi, je suis née au Maroc, à Avro, dans le Moyen Atlas.
I was born in Morocco in the Middle Atlas Mountains.
Et donc, mes deux filles sont nées en Maroc, les deux garçons, ils sont nés en France.
My two daughters were born in Morocco and my two sons were born in France.
Voilà.
Yeah.
And why did you move to France from Morocco?
Et pourquoi vous avez quitté le Maroc pour la France?
Oh ben parce que d'abord, le Maroc avant, c'était dictateur français, c'était français, donc il n'y en avait aucun problème entre la France et le Maroc. Et on n'avait pas besoin ni visa ni papier pour venir en France.
Because at that time, Morocco was under the French rule and there was no problem to leave Morocco and come to France. We didn't need any visas at the time.
Et donc, je suis venue avec mon ex-mari parce qu'on avait des amis français. Et on est venu en France, il y avait du travail, il n'y avait aucun problème.
And I came with my ex-husband to France. We had French friends, and at that time, there was no problem about getting work. There were no problems at all, so we came to France.
Did it surprise you to learn that the French authorities are telling the FBI that Moussaoui is a known Islamic militant?
Est-ce que vous étiez surpris d'entendre, quand vous avez su que les autorités françaises ont dit à leurs homologues américains que votre fils est un islamiste connu?
Ben moi, je viens de l'entendre maintenant. C'est la première fois que j'ai entendu ça. Hein?
This is the first time I've heard this, you know.
Parce que je n'ai pas pensé, parce que moi j'ai posé la question, pourquoi chercher Zachary? Ils m'ont dit, c'est rien, c'est parce qu'il y en avait...
Aisha Awafi, mother of Zacharias Moussaoui, the French citizen accused of being the 20th hijacker in the September 11th attacks. She spoke to us from her home in France, and we continued the conversation. At the end of it, I asked her if she had any message for the American people, and she thought about that, and... she responded, and Sputnik Kalambi translated.
I just want to say that all I'm asking is that my son be given a fair trial and that he not be treated as a scapegoat. The death penalty is a totally barbaric thing. The America is a great country. They have a great people. They should not resort to barbaric customs like the death penalty. All I'm asking for is a fair trial for my son. If he's guilty of something, let him be judged for what his crimes are, not for what he's not done.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Aisha Awafi, the mother of Zacharias Moussaoui, and Sputnik Kalambi. Thank you. You are listening to Democracy Now! That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Our website is www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. And you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. From the studios of Downtown Community Television, DCTV, just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Leading from your window pane to a place behind the sun, just a step beyond the rain. Somewhere over the rainbow, away up high, there's a land in a lullaby, somewhere over. skies are blue and the dreams that you care to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind.